Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ladd Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who talks about the renewed debate on America's epidemic of firearms violence and the failure of Congress to enact basic gun safety regulations. Climate activist Heather Doyle, who describes the mistreatment she suffered during a civil disobedience arrest at the construction site of Maryland's Cove Point Natural Gas Export Terminal. And Patty Lavera of Food and Water Watch, who explains why her group and others oppose the FDA's recent approval of genetically modified salmon to be sold in food stores across the U.S. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Despite uncertainty, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico made $354 million in debt payments on December 1st, but warned it may not be able to pay all of its debts in coming months. Puerto Rico's governor, Alejandro García Padilla, issued orders to claw back a portion of the revenue dedicated to paying some of its lower-ranked debts, a decision which is likely to set off lawsuits. Currently, Puerto Rico's public debt sells for 75 cents on the dollar. Governor Padilla told a U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee his island government was broke and faced an impending liquidity crisis, insisting, "This is a distress call from a ship of 3.5 million people that is adrift at sea." For a decade, Puerto Rico has been mired in recession and increasing poverty. The island's average income is now 30% below that of Mississippi, the poorest state in the U.S. Former New York State Lieutenant Governor Richard Ravitch, who ran the New York City's transit system in the 1980s, declared that without bankruptcy protection, Puerto Rico would face endless acrimonious litigation in both New York and Puerto Rican courts. Julio Lopez of the New York advocacy group Make the Road told the Guardian newspaper that the Federal Reserve may have the authority to intervene to push bondholders to renegotiate the Commonwealth's soaring debt, a move that would not require congressional approval. Raw sewage and other pollutants in the waters off Rio de Janeiro presented a serious health threat to German Olympic sailor Eric Heil, who was treated last August for MRSA, a flesh-eating bacteria, after he participated in a pre-Olympic sail in coastal Brazil. Water tests commissioned by the Associated Press last summer found that water pollution and pathogens off Rio's coast is more extensive than previously disclosed. Raw sewage from upstream communities and storm drains pour into the city's Guanabara Bay. Bacteria tests confirm that viruses directly linked to sewage were 1.7 million times higher than safe levels in the U.S. and Europe. Yet the World Health Organization has vacillated on whether or not to require Rio's Olympic Games officials to conduct tests for viral pathogens in the wake of the AP's July report. In winning its bid for the 2016 Summer Olympics, the government pledged to clean up the city's polluted waters, including upgrading their sewage treatment plants. Brazilian officials now acknowledge that won't be possible. During last summer's trial runs in Rio, the International Sailing Federation and the World Rowing Federation reported that 7% of its Olympic athletes became ill through exposure to Rio's polluted waters. With new large donors from Silicon Valley, the Democratic Party is suddenly having an identity crisis when it comes to defining workers' rights. The nation's tech Democrats, who made fortunes on the sharing economy, want the government to support expansive trade deals, performance-based funding that encourages charter schools to abandon teachers' unions, and authorize an unlimited number of visas to import high-skilled workers. New York Times political columnist Thomas Edsel recently opined, "The replacement of working-class whites with upscale professionals has turned the Democratic coalition into an alliance built on class division." Edsel further stated, "While constituting a minority, the relatively upscale wing clearly dominates the party and provides the majority of activists who run campaigns, serve as delegates to the convention, and have become the core of the party's donor base." The communications industry has now eclipsed labor unions as one of the larger donors to liberal candidates, and as a result, on nearly every major issue, the Democratic Party leadership sides with the tech industry whenever it conflicts with labor union priorities. According to the Guardian newspaper, Tech donors are now a big factor in determining the Democratic 2016 presidential nominee, where Hillary Clinton has embraced tech industry views on education and immigration, while insurgent Bernie Sanders is appealing to blue-collar workers and promoting an FDR New Deal Democratic Socialist agenda. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Over the last 2 weeks, the nation has witnessed two high-profile mass shooting incidents. First in Colorado Springs on November 27th, where a lone gunman attacked a Planned Parenthood clinic that killed three and wounded nine. Then on December 2nd, when a couple attacked a holiday gathering at San Bernardino, California's Inland Regional Center, killing 14 and wounding 21 others. One of the shooters, Saeed Farouk, worked with and knew his victims, in an attack that appears to be motivated by extremist Islamist ideology. There is now a mass shooting every day in the United States, with a mass shooting defined as incidents in which four or more people are reported to have either been killed or injured. But while mass murder incidents understandably capture headlines and dominate cable news programs, the deadly crisis in gun violence can be seen in the 30,000 murders and suicides that occur each year in the U.S., And while the public is angry about the epidemic of gun violence, the NRA and their well-compensated allies in the Republican Party have consistently blocked common-sense gun regulations that would make it more difficult for felons, individuals with a history of mental illness, and even those listed on the federal terrorist watch list to buy firearms. Your reporter spoke with Ladd Everett, Director of Communications with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who talks about America's ongoing gun violence crisis and the continuing failure of Congress to enact basic gun safety regulations, such as universal background checks.
It almost appears to me at this point that the details of any given mass shooting tragedy don't matter so much. They're all similar stories. Even the San Bernardino story has many elements of previous mass shootings. I mean, there's an element of workplace violence there with this disagreement at the party that became violent. Certainly, it's a terrorism case, obviously, so it has ties to international terrorism and that element of violence. You know, the violence we're seeing in this country almost appears to me now like anarchy. It's just spontaneous. It's happening constantly. These are major incidents, not lesser incidents. You know, in many ways, it reminds me of what our founders wrote about the period during the Articles of Confederation, really the unrest in the country we saw at that point, all the violence, the rebellion. It feels to me like we're starting to get back to there, you know. That's of course why the founders wrote the Constitution in the first place, because the government could not tamp down on it. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing today. You know, the NRA has created a situation where they've made it impossible for our government to control the violence and reduce it. So, you know, it's got to start with regime change. It's like anything else. It's going to start with regime change. And you know, the November 2016 elections are going to be hugely important. There's just no doubt about it. And, you know, we're going to go full out, and we're going to be resourced. We'll have Mayor Bloomberg's pack and also Gabby Gifford's pack, and, you know, we're going to go fully at them. And I am optimistic moving forward. I think a lot of what we're seeing now is reactionary politics, you know, all the hate speech and all this craziness. But, you know, that doesn't have an indefinite lifespan.
Ladd, after these recent mass shooting incidents, there's been a predictable spike in sales of guns all across the country. I was here in Connecticut at a sporting goods store, and I saw people lined up to get guns. It's quite a disturbing cycle of violence there in the public square, and then how that translates to people's fear and concern and rumors of gun confiscations and how that drives up sales of guns across the country.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no shortage of fear-mongering in, you know, mainstream media, in mainstream politics today. It's gotten to extreme levels. And there's a lot of violence occurring, and there's a lot of hate speech, too. There's a tremendous amount right now in our politics, in our media, on, you know, on Fox News. There's a tremendous amount of hate speech people are ingesting daily. And it's, you know, when you combine things like, for example, hate speech with, you know, insurrectionism, the belief that as an individual you have a right to use force of arms to engage in political violence if you feel oppressed, it's just, it's a really lethal cocktail out there right now. And it's sad, you know, as someone who, you know, as folks who love their country, it's hard to look at this and to wonder why we have allowed this to continue so long. I mean, I'm very optimistic we're going to get it fixed, but, you know, one day we're going to have to answer for why we allowed it to go on so long, and I don't know if there is a good answer.
Ladd, assess for us the recent U.S. Senate vote where Republicans essentially blocked a series of proposed gun regulations, including an act to bar individuals on the federal terrorist watch list from purchasing guns, and a measure to close background check loopholes for felons and those with a history of mental illness seeking to buy guns.
Yeah, you know, that's an area for quite a bit of optimism. You're talking about this, they call it the terror gap, you know, allowing these folks on the watch list to legally buy guns. And Republicans have been running from the issue. They don't want to touch it. They don't want to vote on it. Like you alluded to, the Democrats did make them take a couple of test votes on it, a rules vote and then a non-binding vote. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting rhetoric coming out. Like Kelly Ayotte, for example, was tweeting the other day that she supports doing something about this, even though she voted the wrong way on the non-binding vote. So I think a lot of politicians are feeling a great deal of pressure on it, which is great. And, you know, now, you know, we have to see if how the Democrats will, you know, force a vote on this, if they can do that. But that's a great one for people to be calling their members of Congress on right now and just telling them, you know, there is no way in the world people on the terrorist watch list, if they can't fly on planes, they shouldn't be legally stockpiling all the guns they want. I mean, right now, literally, someone on the terrorist watch list could walk into Bob's Gun Shop and buy 1,000 AR-15, buy his entire inventory pretty much if Bob was down with it, and that's it, nothing. No attention from authorities, and that's crazy. So that's one I think we can get some movement on. We'll see how that unfolds.
That was Ladd Everett, Director of Communications with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Learn more about the campaign to enact common sense gun regulations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Last February, climate activists Carling Sutherland and Heather Doyle climbed atop a crane in order to interrupt construction of Dominion Energy's Cove Point Liquefied Natural Gas Export Terminal in Lusby, Maryland, a $3.8 billion project on the shores of Chesapeake Bay. Opponents say the terminal and related industrial infrastructure will bring noise, toxic air pollution, and the possibility of an explosion to residents living in the neighborhood located near the site. They also say the terminal will greatly increase fracking throughout the Marcellus Shale region, where natural gas is extracted, and blow a hole in any attempt to rein in carbon pollution, the major contributor to climate change. The women are members of a local direct action group called Stopping Extraction and Exports Destruction, or SEED. After the pair were arrested, Sutherland accepted a sentence of probation, while Doyle opted for a 40-day jail sentence so as not to limit her options for participating in direct action after she's released. Upon the completion of their trials, both activists filed formal complaints against the Calvert County Sheriff's Office for their treatment during their arrests, both the dangerous way in which they were removed from the crane and other abuses. Those complaints were later dismissed, and the women were then slapped with an additional charge, making a false statement to police. Heather Doyle is now pursuing the case in court. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who's been active in opposing the Cove Point LNG terminal, spoke with Doyle as she awaited trial on the new charge. Here she describes the mistreatment suffered, why she believes activists should challenge police charges in court, and what she hopes to accomplish in the case.
There was one sheriff who had been up there with me previously, and then there were two other officers who held both of my arms back, one each, and the other sheriff was standing over top of me, and he pressed his forearm into my throat, right into my larynx. And he did that for what felt like a really long time, and then he let off, and then he stared at me, and then he pushed his forearm back into my throat again for a shorter period of time. After he did all those things, and I wasn't resisting at all. I was being held down by, you know, two other very large men. I'm like a pretty small person, and I wasn't struggling at all. After the sheriff choked me, he lifted up his boot, and he placed the bottom of his boot into my chest, right into my rib cage, and started pressing down really hard right onto my sternum. And I felt like I was being crushed. And then he eventually let off, and he said, oh, you know, like I just tripped or I misplaced my foot when I was stepping over you. We filed formal complaints, both me and the other activists. We filed formal complaints about our mistreatment by the sheriff. So those formal complaints were lodged with the Calvert County Sheriff's Office. Because what happened to me included an assault by one of the sheriffs, my report was a brutality complaint, and then the other person's complaint was just more generally like how they risked her life, like up at the top of a crane.
So what happened after you filed your complaints?
They've charged us under, it's a misdemeanor statute that is just false statement to a police officer. Well, they investigated our complaints and concluded there was no merit for it, but then they turned around and also filed these new charges against us. They filed the charges in the beginning of July.
Heather Doyle, you're going back to court in January, and you're not sure when your trial will be. But why are you taking this case to trial when so many activists, when they're arrested, just pay a fine or plead to a lower charge and don't go through the court process, which is a real hassle, as of course you know, not to mention expensive?
Specifically with this charge, you know, we see this as an intimidation tactic designed to stop people who are opposing the Dominion Cove Point LNG export facility, which is still deeply in the process of being built and endangering 20,000 people living in Lesbia. That feels extremely important to me, that this is a continuation of the fight, and that, you know, as folks who are, you know, active in resisting extraction industry and these big corporations who have bought their way into, like bought a lot of power and influence in Calvert County, we need to keep standing up to that, because it's just about retaliation and trying to shut us down to keep us from continuing the fight. And then just specifically in terms of, you know, why fight this charge, because I didn't lie about what happened to me. I was assaulted by the Calvert County Sheriff during this action.
A lot of activists trying to stop Dominion's construction at Cove Point note that some Calvert County sheriffs wear two hats. They work for the county, and they are also paid to do security for Dominion. And you and other activists say that's a conflict of interest. Are you going to use your trial to expose some of this conflict?
Absolutely. The sheriffs have an interest in trying to neutralize people who are trying to stop this Dominion export facility from being built, because the county has a security services agreement with Dominion, and Dominion is paying Calvert County $1.24 million a year to provide them with security. Additionally, a lot of the Calvert County sheriffs are working as contracted security for the project, so the lines are really blurred here. So we're hoping that in the course of this trial, that it'll become apparent that the reason that I've been charged and I'm being put through this whole new process is because the Calvert County Sheriff's Office has decided to spend a whole lot of their time and effort building a case against me. And it's almost like there's a large corporation that's paying them a lot of money to try to get an activist however they can.
That was Heather Doyle, a climate activist with the group SEED. For more information on the group's mission and their legal defense fund, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration's recent approval of genetically modified salmon, created by the Aqua Bounty Company of Massachusetts to be sold to consumers across the country, is meeting with strong opposition from consumer, environmental groups, and the fishing industry. The genetically engineered fish, known as the Aqua Advantage salmon, has genes from three other species, including DNA from an Atlantic salmon, a growth gene from a Pacific Chinook salmon, and a growth on switch from an eel-like fish, the ocean pout. The sale of what some critics now call the frankenfish will mark the first time that a genetically engineered animal has been approved to enter America's food system. The Aqua Advantage salmon grow twice as fast as typical native salmon species and consume about 10% less food, great attributes to maximize corporate profits. In early 2012, consumer groups Food and Water Watch, Consumers Union, and the Center for Food Safety unsuccessfully filed a petition asking the FDA to test the genetically engineered salmon as a food additive, not as a new animal drug, which requires a less rigorous review. Environmental groups also urged the FDA to conduct an environmental study, citing concerns that GE salmon could escape and carry disease to and/or breed with native wild salmon species. But in the end, the FDA approved the sale of the Aqua Bounty salmon using less thorough testing, reviewing a company study that only examined six salmon. But what's more alarming to opponents of genetically engineered food products is that the government won't require the labeling of these fish. Your reporter spoke with Patty Lavera, Assistant Director of Food and Water Watch, who explains why her group and other organizations oppose the FDA's approval of Aqua Bounty's GMO salmon.
So this would be the first food animal that's going to be allowed on the market that's been genetically engineered. There have been some previous animals, but they weren't things that were destined for our food. So this is a big precedent, and we, lots of groups, including Food and Water Watch, opposed it for a long time. There's a bunch of reasons we're concerned about it. We don't need it. The supposed, you know, benefit from this and why they engineered this salmon is that it's supposed to grow faster in fish farms and get to market size sooner. It's not clear if that's actually going to hold up, but that's what they said. That's, you know, there's a whole conversation there about whether we need to do that or we have other ways we can get people fish as a food. And then we have a lot of questions about what FDA doesn't really know about this thing. So we had a lot of questions and we were concerned about the review process they used, both in terms of whether it's safe to eat and whether it poses risks to the environment. And we don't think FDA did a very good job on either of those fronts. And so that's why we were very unhappy to see them approve this.
What's the environmental record of this company that's producing these GMO salmon, Aqua Bounty? I've read some disturbing reports of how they've conducted themselves as a food-producing company.
So this is a company that is headquartered in the United States, but when they got approved by the FDA, they put a very specific business plan into the FDA for producing this GMO salmon. And that business plan is that they would raise the eggs, the fish eggs, at a facility in Canada, and then they would raise the fish themselves. They take those eggs and they would, you know, grow them out, the full-sized fish, at a facility in Panama, and then they would send just the pieces, you know, they would send the pieces that we were going to eat to the United States. That's what got approved by the FDA. And in looking at the materials and the review process, we do have some concerns about what's been going on with the facilities that the company has run. So there are Canadian environmental groups who are currently suing the Canadian government for their review process of letting that facility in Canada happen. In the course of that lawsuit, we've gotten some documents that have been released about problems at that plant, including, you know, an outbreak of disease at that plant in Canada that the FDA didn't know about until a bunch of groups like ours, you know, let them know it was in those Canadian documents. And then the Panamanian facility actually got fined by the government there for violations of their environmental rules, and there have been some incidents. There's still a very vague description of what happened. Something went wrong at one point a few years ago, and all of the salmon that they had been growing there, they described as lost, and we still don't have a great handle on what happened there. Probably they just died, but it's not clear. So there's a lot of questions about whether this is a company that is on top of what we need if you're going to do something this controversial, which is real containment to make sure they don't get out.
What is the first date that these salmon are scheduled to be sold in stores across the country?
We don't have a great answer on that, but it should be a little while. They have to start producing them. They just got permission to do so, you know, a few weeks ago before Thanksgiving. So I've seen different reports, but most reports say it would be many months to well over a year before these would hit the market. One of the problems, though, is that the FDA gave this permission. They said it's legal now to sell this product, but they did not require it to be labeled. They had a choice to do so. That was an option on the table. They laid out conditions for how you could, the company could voluntarily choose to label it, but they didn't require it. And that's going to cause a lot of chaos as people are concerned about this. It's going to cause a lot of confusion. So people probably aren't going to run into it in stores right away, but at some point they could, and we're left kind of having to use other labels to try to figure this out.
What can you tell us about the organizing yours and other groups are doing to try to prevent genetically modified salmon from making its way to food stores across the countries and restaurants?
Yeah, so if people are on a list of a group like Food and Water Watch or Friends of the Earth or Center for Food Safety, a lot of groups are working together to try to get more retailers to do this. You know, we spent a lot of years trying to get the FDA not to do this. Unfortunately, they did, and so now we have to deal with that reality. One way to deal with that is to try to get more grocery stores to make a position, you know, to make their company policy that they won't stock this. And so if you are on email lists for groups like ours, you'll be getting notices about ways to get involved with that. If you don't want to wait for that, wherever you go shop, you could find the store manager and tell them, or tell them on their Facebook or on their website, you know, in a comment page, something like that. And then also, you know, we're talking to lots of folks in Congress about what can we do at least to get people some disclosure. And so there's a pretty good debate going on right now, and I think we'll have some opportunities hopefully soon to push at least a discussion in Congress to say, can we get this thing labeled if it's already been approved? And so the senators from Alaska and some of the coastal states are starting to talk to each other to figure out if there's a way to get that done.
That was Patty Lavera, assistant director of the group Food and Water Watch. Learn more about the issues of food safety, genetically engineered products, and food labeling by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.